Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing the best of my time to the show. Politics without the boring bits. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, for free on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. Coming up on today's episode, it's a threat to democracy, no less. That's according to the media minister, who is concerned about the disappearance of local journalism. Local papers, local websites, even the BBC's cutting back on local radio as well. So we're taking a look at that in our big thing in just a moment. But first, it's a Tuesday, so it must be a how to win an election day. Here's a little teaser of this week's episode. Let's get podcast done. Strike up the band.
There's basically a market failure in coups.
Anybody who's delivered a lot of leaflets will have strong opinions on letterbox design.
I sang the solo of In the Bleak Midwinter on a Decca recording.
Here we are again then. Welcome to How to Win an Election, your insider's guide to the huge political year ahead. I'm Matt Chorley, and we're all back in the studio together again, joined as ever by New Labour mastermind Peter Mandelson, Polly McKenzie, who's Director of Policy for Nick Clegg in the Coalition, and Tory brainbox Daniel Finkelstein. Are we all well?
Thank you very much.
Very well, thank you. Mate.
Good, good. Now, we know that everyone loves the theme song. That's one of the recurring themes of when people get in touch.
Is it a song?
Well, music, theme music, okay. theme tune.
Just to be clear.
A theme tune. And various people have sent in their own versions of the theme song. And Chris in Barnet emailed in saying, I can play the theme to How to Win an Election on my head. Would you like to hear it?
Let's go with that.
So it's quite hard to do. Yeah. Does anyone want to try it?
There's a very interesting book about whether or not other people can understand the tune that you're playing if you tapped it. So if you tapped it and did not tell us it was the theme tune, there's no way any of us would have got what it was.
I definitely couldn't.
I definitely wouldn't have got it.
But we knew
what it was. But this book, Nicholas Epley's Mindwise, is really, really good. It's all about whether we can understand each other. And what it suggests is that you think everybody knows when you tap something that everybody knows what you're tapping, and in fact, nobody knows what you're tapping. And this is an analogy for the way that we all think that other people can read us and we can read other people, but in fact, we're really, really bad at it.
Without all Danny's theories?
Can we hear it again?
Exactly. I'm sorry, that just sounds completely different, right? That's like a kid playing with a stick. I'm sure he's a very nice guy.
There are many different ways to win an election. That's what that is saying to
us. it's an extraordinary piece of audio. Well, if you want to get in touch because you can play the theme tune on a different body part, email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. Or if you want to get in touch with any questions for us about anything that's happening in politics and elections, email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. We look forward to what on earth arrives next week. This week we're asking how to deal with the ghosts of former leaders. Boris Johnson's back to haunt Rishi Sunak at the COVID inquiry. Keir Starmer is dreaming of Margaret Thatcher. How should a leader deal with their predecessors? Danny, if anything which reminds Rishi Sunak that he was part of Boris Johnson's team comes with a risk for him, doesn't it?
Yes. Look, I think he has not dealt with this issue. And it occurred to me when I was looking at the cabinet list that he's now got, which is, you know, David Cameron, Jeremy Hunt, Alex Chalk, Victoria Atkins, Gillian Keegan. He has got a pretty centrist cabinet. He is therefore, in some ways, picked sides, and yet he hasn't. What is it that holds him back from picking sides? Well, it's refusal to deal with what's come before him. He will not say where he stands in relation to Boris Johnson's politics or Liz Truss's. It's actually a bit difficult because in order to do that, you have to kind of establish where it is you think that Boris Johnson did stand, because in many ways, Boris Johnson was actually the most left-wing leader of the Conservative Party since Macmillan. And so you have a great deal of difficulty making that judgment. But my view is, if he was going to give a direction to the Conservative Party, he had to deal more clearly with what he thought about Boris Johnson on ethical issues, what he thought about Liz Truss, which he did, after all, say in the leadership election, on spending issues, and position himself to some extent by contrast with his predecessors. Otherwise, every time he sort of says, I'm going to make a change, against what? Against, well, you know, he said 30 years and then he pointed David Cameron. So what is the, against what is he making this change? And what, and to what extent do we blame him for the policies that were implemented by the government he was a member of? Yeah. Does he distance himself from them or not? He hasn't made a choice about that for one reason or another, whether it's out of politeness or it's out of confusion, or I don't know what it is, but I think it's a mistake.
It should be quite simple for Sunak in a way, because what Johnson offered in 2019 was a mixture of sort of Brexit-y nationalism and high-spending socialism. I mean, he was a sort of national socialist in that sense. I mean, not in a Nazi sense, but, you know, he was a national, I mean, he was,
just to be clear,
he was both nationalist and socialist. Now, both of those sort of are dead in the water. I mean, nobody is remotely interested in revisiting Brexit. We've been through our sort of nationalist stage, we've passed through our Brexit therapy, and we've come through the other side. Nobody wants to be dragged back to that, and we're in a deep fiscal hole, which means that socialism is not going to arrive anytime soon. So it shouldn't be hard for Sunak to set out a completely different sort of way forward and scheme of things. But unless he sort of removes himself, airlifts himself out of this sort of Johnson vortex, I just don't see how the public will view him as credible, viable, and somebody, you know, who's a sort of, who's born to lead. He just, I mean, perhaps he's just too big a problem in the Conservative Party. Perhaps they're just so divided and he doesn't want to reignite all those sort of tensions and spats and battles, and it's not an option for him. But it's certainly, to my mind, if he's going to stand any chance of winning the next election at all, you know, hovering on zero probably, but if he's going to stand a chance, he's got to sever himself. He's got to separate himself from Johnson.
But I think we easily get confused, because Boris Johnson is such a big character, between his personal and kind of deficits or problems and whether his political pitch was right. Because as Peter says, and Danny says he's left-wing, I mean, left-wing, right-wing, it's a bit hard to pin him down, but there was that high-spending but sort of, and still quite socially liberal kind of agenda that Boris Johnson had. And that's not actually what brought him down with the voters. What brought him down was that he was involved in a whole bunch of parties and a whole bunch of scandals, which he didn't manage to deal.
Lying, rule-breaking,
yeah, exactly.
Chaos.
Yeah, some, you know, stuff like that, right? I didn't want him to be the Prime Minister. But nevertheless, he was brought down by character faults, not by the failure of his political pitch. And I think what the Conservatives have struggled to engage with is that, despite the kind of external factors that Peter mentions, that's still probably the best political pitch for the Conservatives to have, slightly more.
But how do you convert that pitch into policies? I mean, Johnson didn't succeed in sort of, you know, laying out and pursuing a coherent set of policies. I mean, he had a pitch, yes. It's the one I think I described.
I actually would turn to the Levelling Up white paper, which is about 900 pages long.
Went nowhere.
No, exactly. It went
good
nowhere.
White paper went nowhere.
But you're, that's not the point, though. The point is, it is a very coherent political and policy pitch grounded in evidence and pragmatism.
Yeah, I agree.
Crafted by Michael Gove. You're right, they didn't do anything, but that's not the same as saying there's no way to translate the pitch into politics.
I completely policy. Agree.
It's that they just didn't do it because, A, Why? They got distracted, and B, because
of chaos.
The next lot are, in fact, not in favour of that stuff. They're still lost in this sense of what... Because Boris Johnson's agenda fell...
So what
fell,
are they in favour of?
Well, I don't know. I mean...
No, but I don't...
All the many the things person. We can hold...
Danny, Danny, come on. What are they in favour of?
I'm not going to do that, because that's divert us from the conversation we're having into a long conversation about Tory manifesto.
You can tell
but
me
I,
after.
But I, well, OK. But I agree with Polly. I don't actually think... I think they... did know roughly what they where they were going. There was a lot of dispute about whether it was the right direction or not, mainly because Boris Johnson was also opposed to the consequences of his own position. So we've got a very good example of this with the row about immigration. Everyone starts having a massive row about how there's too much immigration. The government does something about it. Everyone then complains that means there won't be enough. Right? So people... And Boris Johnson was opposed to some of the consequences of his own policy. So, for example, he was in favour of big expenditure on infrastructure, expanding social spending and social responsibilities to things like social care, but also against putting up any of the taxes necessary to pay for it. So this ended up being a dispute with Rishi Sunak, mainly about whether or not you could be that fiscally irresponsible. You asked the question, Peter, could he oppose... Boris Johnson more explicitly? And the answer is, I think he's already paying the price for the fact that he's distanced himself from Boris Johnson. He may as well get the benefit from it. He's not, in other words, he's already opposed
he's paying
by...
the price inside his own party.
Yes, inside the Conservative Party, any price that Rishi Sunak will ever pay for not being Boris Johnson, for opposing Boris Johnson, for bringing Boris Johnson down, he's paying that already.
But he's ended up in the no man's land.
Correct. That's exactly what I'm saying. So he what he's not doing is taking advantage of that. So he absolutely can, because he already is bearing the political costs of distancing himself from Boris Johnson. And my question to him would be, well, if you're already paying the price, why don't you get the benefit from it in terms of a public argument? Because every public argument you try, the route runs through saying, we're not going to run the government in the same way. It's not so much that you're distancing yourself from him politically, although there were certain issues on kind of rule of law issues.
Basically, Danny, you're saying that what Sunak's got to do is do a Starmer. What Starmer has done to Corbyn, he's got to do to Johnson. Yes, I mean, he's got to disavow him, repudiate him, perhaps not cut him off completely at the knees, but disqualify him from standing the next election, which is an extreme, mould-breaking approach by Keir Starmer to his predecessor.
Is it too much?
No, it's not too much. No. It's necessary, inevitable, and exactly what the public demands. And what's interesting about it is that the party hasn't risen up in revolt against it.
But there's still not that simple, though, because what is he going to repudiate about Boris Johnson? The idea of governing like a sort of bear in a tea shop, he can repudiate that. But the central proposition was actually well structured to bring together the coalition that won Boris Johnson the 2019
so
election.
So it's Johnsonism without Johnson.
Exactly. So if he's going to distance himself from that more sort of centrist high spending agenda, he can do that, but that in fact plays to the more extreme wing of the Conservative Party. And so that's doing exactly what Danny advised him not to do last week, which is to tack towards what might win you the election. He needs Johnson without Johnson.
But he can just make that argument. And what I'm saying is, I think actually, relatively speaking, it's relatively easy. Boris Johnson, in fact, has also been removed from Parliament in the same way that has happened to Starmer and Corbyn. And Starmer took his time over this. The first shadow cabinet he appointed was designed to obscure all political choices, to appoint people who had no trace of politics that you could tell in the background in the Labour Party.
And then
about halfway through, it's a caricature of it, but I think it's reasonable.
You're exaggerating to make a point.
Exactly. Yes. halfway through this, how does one cope with this?
I know, it's exhausting.
No, come to the end.
I've begun to become sympathetic to Gordon Brown over this.
He's had a double dose of granola this morning, I think.
It's enough to drive one bananas. But anyway...
bananas and a small pot of yogurt.
You know, about halfway through the parliament, yeah. He did then.
Then he made a choice. Just because we're talking about Keir Starmer and Tory leaders, is he right to say he admires Margaret Thatcher, Peter?
Of course, he's right to say that she was a strong prime minister who had a vision for the country, at one stage, a fairly well worked out plan and some changes that would, in her view, benefit the country. Why shouldn't he say that? I mean, what he wants to...
But was it a bit... So we were discussing this yesterday. Not, is it a bit try-hard writing an I Love Margaret Thatcher piece in the Sunday Telegraph?
It wasn't an I Love Margaret Thatcher. It was saying, this is the sort of Prime Minister that the country needs. I mean, that's why he's associated himself with Blair, with Attlee, to an extent Wilson. These were sort of modernising Prime Ministers with a vision and a plan. You can argue as to what extent each of them fulfilled their plan and realised their vision. But they were modernising prime ministers and they were also election-winning leaders as a result. Now, that's why Starmer has embraced Attlee, Wilson and Blair. And when it comes to Thatcher. And when it comes to Thatcher, he's not sort of embracing her philosophy. He's not endorsing all her policies. I mean, that is a matter for debate. I happen to think that some of the things that she did in relation to the economy were timely and necessary. Yeah. I think she also was oblivious to and indifferent to many of the social consequences of her economic policies. Now, that's my view. That's not necessarily Keir Starmer's view. But to say what sort of prime minister he's going to be, I think is very good. And incidentally, it's why Gordon Brown invited Margaret Thatcher into Number 10, a slightly sort of awkward visit that Mrs. T paid to Gordon.
Were you there?
I wasn't there, no, but I sort of followed it acutely on television and I felt acutely embarrassed by it because they all, both of them, looked equally sort of awkward in the whole during the whole thing. And it's why Ed Miliband also said, oh, I want to be like Mrs. Thatcher. Of course, what Ed Miliband wanted to do was to do on the left what Mrs. Thatcher had done on the right. Ed Miliband once explained this to me. He wanted to sort of, from the left, you know, draw the centre ground of British politics onto his and the Labour Party's territory in the way that he believed Mrs. Thatcher had done for the right. And he wanted to be, he told me, I want to be the Mrs. Thatcher of the left.
My critique of Keir Starmer's article was that it was an article in which he said he'd like to be like somebody who had a vision, rather than actually saying what, you know, which wouldn't we all, right? And I think rather than actually set out what it was,
and it's all out of the Tony Blair playbook, isn't it? When you were in 1994, Tony Blair told the Times it was the clear sense of an identifiable project for the Tory party that I did admire. It is absolutely essential in politics. That is what keeps you going,
Matt. This goes back to the discussion we had last week about leading, deciding and dividing.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking about how you deal with dissent in your party. You only encounter people who dissent when you give a clear lead, when you decide and take your party in the country, you know, with clarity and purpose in a direction. That is what Mrs. Thatcher did. Like it or loathe it, that is what she did. And I think that Starmer is right to say that that's the style or model of leadership he wants to adopt as well.
And if you want to hear more of Peter Mandelson, Daniel Finkelstein and Polly McKenzie, the full episode discussing what you do about those pesky former leaders, head over to How to Win an Election, wherever you're listening to this. Right, up next, we're taking a look at local news for local people.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
Yeah, but can you read all about it? As readers increasingly get their news online, it's becoming harder and harder to run a financially sustainable newsroom, particularly for local newsrooms. 320 local newspaper titles closed down between 2009 and 2019 in that decade. Even more have closed since. Advertising revenue fell by 70% between 2010 and 2020. Many small independent newspapers have closed their printers for good. And even the big four publishers, which control almost 90% of the daily print market, they're struggling too. Reach, which is the parent company of the Daily Mirror, the Daily Express, and the biggest publisher of local news, with titles including Liverpool Echo and the Manchester Evening News, they've just announced plans to cut 450 jobs. That's 10% of its workforce. It said in July that just the cost of printing newspapers had gone up by 60% due to spiraling energy prices and the cost of paper, and so it needs to cut costs. It's also making it harder and harder to make money from selling advertising online. Another big problem for news publishers is the BBC has plans to expand its free online local news content. That comes after major plans to cut local BBC radio services. Today, senior local editors from several newspaper companies have joined forces to call on the BBC to abandon these plans, which they claim will undercut their own businesses. So today we're going to take a look at the state of local news and why it matters. The media minister says it's a threat to democracy. We'll hear about that in just a moment. But first, Nancy Fielder is editor-in-chief at National World, one of the publishers of local news, which has joined this call for the BBC to abandon its expansion. Hi, Nancy.
Hello, good morning.
Good to have you with us. Roger Litolis has been a feature writer and columnist for various local newspapers in the Northwest and is the author of Panic as Man Burns Crumpet, The Vanishing World of the Local Journalist. Roger, good to have you with us. We'll get Roger in a minute. We've also got Polly Perkins, former editor of the Burn Grieve Messenger, a local community paper in Sheffield, which closed down early this year. Hi, Polly.
Hi.
We have got Polly. Very good. Nancy, let's start with you, first of all, and explain in detail the issues you have with what the BBC is doing and why it threatens commercial local journalism.
Okay, so, I mean, as you just explained, times are difficult for local journalism. We are constantly reinventing ourselves. We've got some incredibly skilled journalists, all sorts of ages, but they need their salaries paid. Now, the fundamental thing with the BBC is, as we all know, the licence fee, you can't choose to pay it or not pay it. Everybody pays it. It's effectively a tax. And what they're now doing is opening up more than 30 local websites. As you said earlier, just months after huge strikes and massive uproar because they've cut back their radio services, and they're basically parking their tanks on our lawn, and they're going to be able to give local journalism free. It won't be as good as we give. It won't be as in-depth. Some of our titles have got hundreds of years of history, but they won't have to charge for it because we're all paying for it because we pay for it through the license fee. So everything that we've done to build subscriptions, to grow our loyalty, is being undermined by an institution that has got massive challenges. It should be focusing on stop doing so many repeats, improve their national TV coverage, and bring back the local radio stations that are an absolute lifeline in cities like Sheffield, where I am. Radio Sheffield was massively successful, and they've lost a lot of their good presenters, have made them redundant, and it's all broadcast from somewhere else now. It covers a bigger area. So if they want local journalism, focus on what they do. Don't try and close us down.
Polly, let's bring you in there. What's been your experience? Tell me about the Burn Grieve Messenger and whether or not what Nancy was just saying rings true.
So the Burn Grieve Messenger was quite a unique case. It was the only charity-run newspaper in the country. And actually, it was pretty much a two-man job. So as editor, I was also project manager, and I was responsible for finding funding, organising all the journalism that went on, and also sorting out the distribution. And it started off well funded by organisations like the National Lottery and getting quite a bit of public money. This gradually diminished, as all charities have seen recently. And that then meant that it was simply me and a designer running the whole thing. Whether or not it had been financially sustainable, that wasn't sustainable. It wasn't possible for two people to do that much work. And then the funds stopped coming in, and the National Lottery said they wanted to reduce the amount of projects they were funding in Sheffield, because they felt they were funding too many charities in Sheffield, and they needed to fund more broadly. But of course, the reason so many charities in Sheffield needed funding is because Sheffield gets less public funding than many other places. So there were lots of strains involved in the collapse of the Messenger.
I suppose the point is, I mean, the fact it was a charity points to the idea that the reporting of local news is intrinsically important. But it's really
Absolutely.
Hard to it's labour intensive, and it's hard to make money from it actually, because quite a lot of it is dull hard work, and when people have got, you know, the entirety of everything ever made on their phones, you know, their willingness to pay to read, you know, sometimes dry but quite important stuff about their local area just isn't there in the numbers that it takes to make it viable. Roger, I think we've got Roger now. Roger Latonis, before we come to the vanishing of the local journalist, just explain Panic as Man Burns Crumpet is the title for your book.
The title, we're just looking for a kind of hopefully funny, zany kind of title, and we trawled the local press for some funny headlines, and that was the one we came up with. Sadly, I can't claim to have written the story myself. I've never written anything as good as Panic as a Man Burns Crumpets, but hopefully it's an eye-catching title.
And why did you want to write it? And tell us about the way that the local journalist is disappearing.
I wrote it because I think I've had quite a varied, interesting career, as any long-serving journalist has. I came into journalism in 1995, when local newspapers were still riding high. It seemed as if everyone bought or at least read the local paper at the time. And then there was, until kind of the mid, you know, around 2005, that was probably still the case. But then in the last 15, 18 years or so, there's been a gradual decline. And my career kind of spanned that decline. In fact, 4 years ago, I was made redundant. So I thought it would be good to tell a story not only of a journalist's career and all the variety that brings, but also the decline of journalism itself is kind of personified by my career and also many of the people I knew. I mean, when I began in 95, there were about 70 people working in my newsroom. By the time I finished, there were maybe a dozen people left. I think that kind of decline has been mirrored around the country with all the, you know, the ramifications that brings. I think it's just an important story that probably people outside of journalism won't be aware of it. They still expect to get the same kind of quality of product that they had 20 years ago, and they don't always realise why things have changed so much.
Nancy, I was talking about the cuts at Reach. I know National World have similarly, you know, you've had to cut your cloth as well. So one in four jobs have gone since you took over what used to be Johnson Press. How do you compete? Because, like I said, it's labour-intensive. Often you need to produce more and more stuff. How do you do the stuff that we're talking about, the proper local journalism, the holding the police, the courts, the council to account stuff, while also just, when not just drifting into clickbaity stuff that attracts eyeballs but doesn't actually sort of serve any purpose, the roughage that you want from proper local journalism?
Yeah, I mean, let's not pretend it is a real challenge.
Yeah.
But we are very blessed with two or three generations in a newsroom who are incredibly skilled. I mean, back in the day, you would go out, you'd get a story, you'd phone it back, and that would be it. The people we've now got, and they are coming out of university, and they are still eager for this. They still understand how important local journalism is. They go out, they'll go to a meeting, they'll do a video clip, they'll do a Facebook Live, they will put it on TikTok, and they'll still write the story at the end of the day. We have journalists who work very, very hard, very, very fast, and they do get stories that basically the nationals then follow up several days later and turn them into a story that's of national wide interest. The local journalists on the ground are the ones who know what is going on. As Polly said, Burngreave cannot be served. It's only a small area of Sheffield, but what it had was unique, and it's lost that. And that can't be replaced by something else. Nobody else, the BBC can't come in and do that. Polly's reporters, not that she had many, but the contacts that she had are irreplaceable. And that's what you don't get unless local journalists they represent the community because they're part of it. But it is really hard. And every day there are stories that you have to decide what's your priority today. And there are some stories that, like you say, they might not be the most exciting. Everyone on Facebook is going to click on it because a massive amount of our audience comes from social media to the website. But we believe they still need covering, and so we do. But I don't think there's anything that we do that we think is... I mean, we do funny stuff, we do entertaining stuff. It's not just our job to inform, we want to educate, and we want to give a smile. Yeah, yeah. But so everything we do, but we do to try and give our readers the best possible experience. But every day there's stories that you can't necessarily cover because they go down the priority list. And that is really sad. You might have been able to do that 20 years ago. But financially, a lot of readers don't understand that unless they would have always paid for the newspaper, unless they're willing to subscribe and support us, then there is a threat there. But luckily we've got very, very loyal readers.
And you have on some of your sites, there are subscription models in the same way as, you know, the Times has a paywall and you have to subscribe. Is it on some of your sites, but not all of them, there were subscription models? Is it the case that you would charge for all of them were it not for the BBC? Is it as simple as that? The very existence of a free license fee subsidised news outlet, is that what stops regional journalism from being something that people just have to pay for online?
Well, in other countries, I mean, if you look at Scandinavia, is a great example where they haven't got a BBC, and everybody for the last 20, 30 years has just paid for their local journalism because that's what they did and that was the only way to get it. So whether you remove the BBC, I don't think it would magically solve all our problems.
No, but it's just where we are now,
Yeah, Wolverhampton, the Express and Star is a fantastic, one of the best in the country, local newspapers. It knows what's going on. Nobody else can do what they do. They're just launching a paywall, and guess what? A couple of weeks later, the BBC is going in there for free. So how does that survive? And it's journalism and it's the communities that suffer because they can't do what we do, but they give it away for free. It's not free. We're all paying for it. We're just not paying for it in a way that we see every day.
So, Roger, having looked at the vanity world of the local journalist, did you come away from it more pessimistic, or are there reasons to be optimistic? Let's try to end this on a slightly more optimistic note.
I mean, I think, as Nancy says, it comes down to people have to be prepared to pay for local journalism. I think we all like to think that there's a huge audience that they're out there, you know, who are prepared to invest themselves even small amounts in local journalism because they realise how important it is and the kind of work it can do, the kind of good it can bring to communities. But ultimately it comes down to people actually being willing to put their money where their mouth is and do that. So I think it depends on finding the right models, whether it's subscriptions. Obviously, the BBC, as we've said, doesn't help. But I think, you know, it depends. It's harder for people to pay for journalism. If the quality isn't there, obviously, it's becoming harder for the quality to be there as we've got so many factors working against local journalism. But, you know, we need good journalism and we need people to support it.
And actually, one of the things that we should point out, the BBC do pay for the local democracy reporter scheme, which comes out of the licence fee, which actually, I think, yeah, we've had loads of local democracy reporters on the show, and they're really good, and they sit in the newsrooms of local newspapers and websites and do cover some of those stories that you want to see covered. Polly Perkins, just finally with you, I suppose it's difficult to be optimistic when the burn grief messenger that you ran closed earlier this year. Any reason to be positive?
Well, I think the reasons to be positive are that we all have access to the internet and that people can write about things going on in their local area and can find audiences. But it seems to me deeply undemocratic that local news isn't publicly funded to a greater extent than it is. I don't understand how we can, as a nation, make decisions about the MPs we vote for, make decisions about the campaigning we do, without getting proper investigative journalism happening in our local area. And that can only be done by local people who understand the complex nuances of their communities. That knowledge is acquired over decades. It's not something you can just parachute into an area and gain and then report adequately on. So my call when I attended the Select Committee was we urgently need central government to fund local journalism. That hasn't happened. And so organisations like the Burn Grief Messenger have shut down. And that, frankly, is partly because the funding that used to come to organisations like the Messenger from central government now comes from the National Lottery. And that's a very different thing. Yeah, and the lottery, and no matter how much they fund, can't fund in the way that central government can through taxes. It's simply not a replacement for the arts funding and the other funding that's disappeared and then been sort of shoved on the lottery pile.
And then, like you said, you're then at the whim of each round of bidding and all of that. Polly, really good to speak to you. Polly Perkins, former editor of the Burn Grief Messenger, a local community paper in Sheffield, which closed down earlier this year. We also heard from Roger Latolis, the author of Panic as Man Burns Crumpet, The Vanishing World of the Local Journalist, and Nancy Fielder, editor-in-chief at National World, one of the big four publishers of local news. Right, let's look now at what the government could do to protect the financial sustainability of local journalism. I asked the media minister, Sir John Whittingdale.
Well, there are a number of interventions which government can and have made. In particular, you've mentioned the role of government in trying to ensure that there is a fair balance and negotiating power between the big tech giants like Google and Facebook and the newspapers, because a lot of the news that you see on Google and Facebook is actually derived from journalism by local reporters, and it's only right that they should get recognition and payment for that. So that's something where we have sought to ensure through the Digital Markets Unit that negotiation can take place. We've done a number of things to try and support local newspapers, like reducing business rates, obviously a major campaign during the pandemic of public information advertising. But at the end of the day, government can't subsidise local newspapers. We've got to find a way in which that they can remain viable in a very different landscape.
One of the biggest challenges, and I remember this when I worked in local papers, when trying to build an audience online, was that local newspapers were going up against local BBC websites. And there was this constant complaint that the BBC, providing a free website, made it impossible for local papers to be able to charge. And that was the defence. You know, but the defence was the BBC was there and it did local news that no one else was doing. But now we see the BBC's also cutting its local radio output, less and less local. Do you think the BBC is even fulfilling that remit? Having sort of helped kill off lots of local newspapers, it now seems to be retreating from the thing that we were told it was essential for it to do.
Well, I mean, I've been very critical of the BBC, but at the end of the day, the government can't tell the BBC what to do. But I think they are making a mistake, firstly, by cutting local radio. There are still a lot of people who depend on local radio, particularly more elderly people, and to get rid of some of the local stations and move them to a much broader regional basis destroys the local component. But they're doing that in order, they say, to spend more on digital journalism. And that's where they are competing directly with local newspapers. And local newspapers, understandably, are upset when they are trying to survive by charging people for access to content online and are competing against the free BBC. So, I mean, I do think that the BBC need to think again. We've told that to them. And Ofcom needs to look at whether or not the BBC are delivering on their requirement to deliver for local audiences.
It does seem like it's almost impossible in the digital world to survive. Ultra-local sites, you know, one-man band startups we've heard about closing, while big companies like Reach, you know, who own dozens of papers across the country, national, regional, local, they're laying off, what, 10% of staff. Is it impossible for us to have a thriving local news industry if the BBC is competing with it directly with a free offer, free at the point of use, if you like, without subscription? Is that a sort of an existential threat, do you think, to local and regional news?
Well, I think the BBC are making it harder for local newspapers, but the prime cause of their problem is not the BBC. The prime cause is that people are no longer buying newspapers. They are getting their news content online. So I think that we are seeing a long, slow, but inevitable decline in the printed newspaper, that the model is going to have to change. And in 10 years' time, I fear that not only will you hardly ever see a local printed newspaper, national newspapers will be going in probably in the same direction.
When was the last time you bought a local paper?
Oh, every week. I do.
Oh, very good.
As a constituency member of Parliament, I'm quite keen to find out what my local paper is reporting. And occasionally, I hope it's going to be me. So now I still subscribe to the local paper, but I know from having talked to the editor that the circulation figures are heading steadily downwards.
And just finally, John, what does that mean then? You know, we're talking about the media because we're interested, because we're in the media and you're a media minister. But what does it mean to normal people if councils and courts and police and all those decisions aren't being scrutinised by an independent reporter in your local area? What ultimately does that mean in 5 or 10 years' time?
Well, I mean, I do think it represents a real threat to democracy because, for instance, you know, next May, we will, as usual, have local elections across the country, and people need to know about the performance of their local council and in order to reach judgment. And they need to be able to hear it from impartial, accurate journalists. The trouble is, if that disappears, they will become more and more reliant on social media reports, which often are not accurate, certainly are not balanced, are not legally checked, and are full of wild speculation and rumour. Professional journalism is still vitally important for a functioning democracy. So I am deeply concerned to try and help the newspapers find a way of making sure that they can continue to thrive.
And does that involve the BBC reining its neck in a bit?
Well, the BBC is helping in some ways. And we've talked about the competition from BBC local news websites, but at the same time, there's something called the Local Democracy Reporting Service, which we worked with the BBC to set up, which is where the BBC is funding some journalists for local newspapers. So, you know, that's the kind of model where, you know, the BBC and government are actually trying to support newspapers. But we need to look across the board and find a lot of different ways in which we can try and make sure that newspapers and journalism at a local level continues to survive.
That was John Whittingdale, Sir John Whittingdale, the media minister, discussing the impact of what's happening in local news and the local BBC output on the state of democracy. He mentioned there that he hoped that journalists would be able to create new, sustainable business models online. Well, having heard about some which didn't work, let's speak to someone who thinks they might have cracked it. Yoshi Herman is the editor of The Mill, a digital news startup based in Greater Manchester. But now you're taking over the world, aren't you, Yoshi?
Haven't crashed it yet.
Just explain, because you just explain to people what the mill is and the extent to which you think you might have cracked this idea of how you can pay for people to produce proper journalism locally.
Yeah, so the Mill is a publication I started a few years ago, and we publish in-depth, high-quality journalism about Greater Manchester, and it's delivered via an email newsletter. And the fundamental way it's funded is from readers paying subscriptions rather than advertising online. So it started that in Manchester, and then we started a sister newsletter called The Tribune in Sheffield, another one called The Post in Liverpool, another one now called The Dispatch in Birmingham, all based on the same model. You have relatively low cost, but you have really high quality journalism and people pay for it. And I think that's a much better model for local news. We've now got about 5,500 paying subscribers across the different cities. We've got loads and loads of stories that are kind of like, you know, making a real impact, creating social change, prompting people to think differently about the places they live. So I think that's a much more sustainable model. I think the model that's been pursued across local media for the past 20 years, which is give away most of your stuff for free and then expect the ad revenue to make up the gap, I think that hasn't worked.
Just give us a sense of how much, if I wanted to subscribe to the Mail, how much would that cost?
£7 a month.
And is that enough then for you to pay the people who are producing the content properly?
Yeah, so we've got 10 people on full-time staff now. We also spent about £30,000 last year on freelance journalism. We're not paying, you know, we're not paying as much as the, I'm sure the New York Times is, but we're paying equivalent to what other local newspapers are paying. And I hope as we go along, we'll be able to pay more than regional and local newspapers, because currently journalism is, you know, it stopped being a sustainable career for a lot of people. A lot of people, you know, when they have kids, when they have get a mortgage or whatever, they can't stay in local journalism anymore because the money has stagnated for 30 years. I'm hoping that in future we will be able to pay, you know, substantially better than local newspapers currently do.
And your approach is to do less, to do fewer things better. You know, one or two really interesting stories, rather than the sort of throw everything at the wall and hope some of it sticks or somebody comes across it and, you know, just enough eyeballs. That actually you think that it's almost like the, you know, it sounds like the opposite. The people want, you know, they're willing to pay to get less, but because it's good.
Yeah, I think people want to pay for stuff where they know everything they get is going to be fact-checked, it's going to be thoughtful, editors will have looked over it. Like, we do actual editing back and forth, back and forth with a writer, which feels like a little bit of an anachronism in this world of, like, you know, there are lots of local papers now where things don't really get edited, they just get thrown up. As you say, they're going for, like, publishing dozens or hundreds of things a day. And by the way, Matt, they're not doing that because they love publishing press releases or they love publishing stories about something a celebrity said on Instagram this morning. It is because their business model, which is primarily about online advertising, incentivizes them to do that. You can only make money from online advertising if you reach tens of millions of people a month, because you make very little money per click. And therefore, you have to go for this kind of scale model where you're publishing as much as possible. If you say our main business model is going to be money coming from readers, as you guys know at the Times, you can prioritize quality and you can prioritize a smaller volume of content. So we've gone down that path. And I think probably local journalism should have gone down that path the moment the internet came along, rather than going down this sort of mail online strategy.
Well, it's really interesting, your approach. Yoshi Herman, good to speak to you, the editor of The Mill, the digital news startup in Greater Manchester. Loads of you getting in touch about this, actually. Mike says, wouldn't devolution to the regions provide a shot in the arm for local journalism? An excellent use of shot in the arm, a phrase only used by local journalists. Stephen in Sussex says, the local media point being discussed. Look at what happens in the US. Democracy is in a dire state, not helped by the absence of independent news locally and nationally. I mean, it's an interesting point there, Stephen. And you know, what's happened in America, you know, tends to wash up here in terms of they've lost so many local papers. Sam in Brecon says, funding local news. Local news should be funded by a levy on football clubs. A small levy for lower league minnows and local teams. Large levies for the Premiership. Football, especially at the high level, is awash with money, but it's both a local industry and also covers the whole of the nation. Clubs benefit from local match reporting and local community involvement. It would give good football football, it would give football a good chance to give something back to the locals. I mean, it's a radical idea, Sam. And then Lisa gets in touch and says, I have an online Times subscription. Invariably, I end up buying a copy too, which is nuts. But I find reading online irritating. And I also seem to miss stuff. A proper newspaper is so, so satisfying. Well, if we could get everyone to do that, Lisa, we would have no trouble at all. Get yourself a subscription and buy a copy of the paper. And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes, and tell your friends. Why don't you? But for now, for me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.